From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1991, Troy Davis was convicted of the murder of Savannah police officer Mark McPhail and sentenced to death. The case erupted into a firestorm, a lack of physical evidence and the optics. Davis was black. McPhail, a white police officer, led to questions about Davis's guilt. Supporters argued for a new trial. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter petitioned to stop Davis's execution. In the end, he was put to death by lethal injection in 2011, and still questions remained. Atlanta-based playwright Lee Knoll made an inquiry of many perspectives on the case through her play Beyond Reasonable Doubt, the Troy Davis Project.
They're going to execute him, Allison.
No, they're not.
No matter what you do, they are going to execute him. And it will be the right thing to do because he's guilty. He is guilty and he deserves what's coming to him.
That play premieres this Sunday on GPB as an audio drama and online as a podcast. Lee Knoll joins us now to talk about its inspiration and evolution. Lee, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
The Davis case was so emotionally fraught, so controversial. What about the case made you imagine it as a play?
I thought it was interesting that everyone seemed to have an opinion on it and everyone seemed to think that they were right no matter what they believed. And I wanted to know why it was that so many people could be in opposition to each other. What were the things that were driving them to believe what they believed and to fight for what they fought for?
So how did you go about it? What kind of resources did you use to get a feeling for the story?
Well, I did a lot of research for many years. I read 1,500 pages of trial transcripts, the recantations, Judge Moore's ruling. I interviewed anyone who would talk to me. I tried to talk to other people who would not talk to me. I read everything on the internet from blogs to every article, video I could get my hands on, and then looked at everything that was laid out on the floor and said, okay, what tells this story in the most cohesive way possible and in the fairest possible way, meaning I'm going to give equal validity to both sides of this argument.
So how much of this is based on the facts or actual transcripts, and how much of it is artistic creation, your sense of character?
Well, the characters walk into the play having one opinion about the case, and through the course of an act, they read things or they come into contact with things or other people who have different concepts about the case. And they are persuaded one way or another, depending upon what they read or what they saw. So about 50% of the dialogue in the play itself consists of things that I took directly out of the trial transcripts and out of the recantation. So all of the stuff that the characters read are straight up fact out of records or out of things that people told me.
And how much did you know, Lee, about the death penalty in Georgia before starting to write this?
I knew that the death penalty ended nationally, and I knew that it started up again in Georgia, in Atlanta. And the fact that the Troy Davis case was fought in Atlanta, part of it, was really interesting in that perspective. I have no idea why it is that Atlanta and Georgia are the kind of the revolving door of the death penalty, but I found that really interesting.
When Troy Davis was executed, hundreds of people gathered outside of the state prison in Jackson. Reporters and TV crews swarmed the area, and many, many voices spoke up for and against his execution. So what was your goal there, to reflect that kind of opposition and that complexity, and how do you do that?
I was interested in faithfully representing why people would believe what they believed. Was it something that they had experienced in their lives? Was it something that they walked in the door with? Was it something else that tied them into it? I was also waiting. You know, we didn't know if he was going to be executed or not. That was up in the balance for a while. And after he was executed, I read everything that I could get my hands on about people's response after the execution. So that was really interesting, too, to see how people shifted or didn't shift. Most people didn't shift at all.
Yeah, what shifts an opinion? That's an interesting thing, I think, for a playwright. Obviously, that's where the drama is, isn't it?
Right.
How do you reflect that?
I think you make it real. You make it human. You know, we're interested in telling why people believe what they believe. You know, people on the internet right now, the internet has trained us to click on something and then react, click and react, or react and then click and then react again. I think what this play is trying to do is to get us to discern. Can you separate yourself from your reaction, take a step back, and ask, why is it that you believe this person? When is it that your mind started to shift? What is it that you value or you balance in terms of making your own decisions? Because each one of us walks around with our own decisions to make, and those decisions in a larger public sphere are incredibly important.
Did you have a point of view when you started writing the play?
I had a point of view of wanting to know what drove people. I was in the middle of a bunch of arguments. I would find myself weirdly in the middle of a bunch of arguments that people would be having about this case on all sides of it. And the way that people changed in front of me when they would take one side or another about this case was a little frightening, how intractable they became. So my perspective was, what is driving this? What's going on underneath everyone in here?
Did you find yourself going through shifts in your thinking as you're reading transcripts, obviously hearing from human beings giving their sense of the world, their testimony?
Well, when I read the trial transcripts, which took a long time to get, they were very difficult for me to get in an electronic format. That was hard. But when I started reading them, I tried to take a clean slate of my head of everything that I had heard or read or anything and just say, okay, let's just take this from a human perspective. What are these people saying? And reading it from a story perspective, what are these people saying? And I did find myself going, oh, okay, this is what happened on that night. Here's the sequence of events. Oh, okay, this makes sense. And then the next person would get up and completely blow that out of the water. And so I found myself in this weird topsy-turvy world of not knowing who to believe in. And I think that's part of the power of this, is who do you believe? We had an attorney who came to see the play who was not in any way involved in the Torrey Davis case. And he said that he had the exact same experience that he had in a courtroom every day. He walked in and he watched the first act of the play, and he walked out at intermission and was like, there is no way anything you can say to me is going to change my mind in act two. No way. And then he walked into act two, and at the end of the play, he'd flipped his opinion again. So that was very gratifying for me as a playwright, because I wanted to represent what happens in a courtroom and how people in the system and who have to work in the system experience that, as well as the people who watch it from the outside.
There's so many viewpoints to consider, including that of Davis himself, who maintained his innocence until the very end. Here he is speaking to Amnesty International in 2007.
This killer is still out there. My family's in mourning. The victim's family's in mourning. And the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice.
Is Davis as a character in the play? Is he a character in the play?
No, Troy Davis is not a character in the play. Mark McPhail is not a character in the play. All the characters in the play are fictitious representations of people that I made up who have particular perspectives that I saw in the Troy Davis case. The only real people who show up in the play itself are people who were involved in the trial and people who are involved in the recantations. And those people are only there as direct quotes of themselves from the trial transcripts. I haven't made any comments or edits or changes. It's just what happened in the courtroom. So I think it's important for people to know what happened in the court of public opinion and what happened in the court of law.
Well, let's pick up on that, because the Georgia DA involved in the case, Spencer Lawton, he wrote a column in a Savannah newspaper saying that there were two Troy Davises, one based on the facts, the other a much more sympathetic character created by media and supporters. So you have the court of law and the court of public opinion. How did you get through that?
Well, I think that Spencer Lawton made a really smart point that there was a court of public opinion and there was a court of law. And the people who won in the court of law lost in the court of public opinion. And the people who won in the court of public opinion lost in the court of law. So both sides won a battle, but both sides lost the war. So that's a very interesting thing to try and untangle that from a human perspective.
We have heard from a number of people since we announced that the radio play and the podcast were coming out. Seems pretty interesting that there's an assumption that the play would be sympathetic to one side or the other.
Yeah, I've struggled with that for 4 years now. Everyone who comes into contact with the idea of this play automatically makes an assumption based on their own personal experience of what the play is going to be. And I understand that from a human perspective. But what I would say is try and, no matter where you are in the perspective of this, just watch the play or listen to the play and see what happens in your mind as you're watching it in your mind. Mm-hmm. That's the only real way that you're going to know how you feel about it. It's interesting to me that the people who are outraged about its very existence are people who were involved in the case to begin with. I will say as a caveat that when it premiered as a stage play at Synchronicity in 2016, we had some people who were involved in the case who came to see the play, who were incredibly concerned about it. We had a Savannah police officer who came up to see it, who had been working in Savannah as a police officer at the time of the crime. We had an attorney who worked on the case who actually started yelling at the actors in the middle of the show because he was so upset by it. And we had members of the Troy Davis family who were also concerned about the play's existence. And when they came to see it, all of their concerns, or at least what they talked about out loud, stopped. Once they saw it, they started changing what they were talking about and what they were thinking about based upon what they'd seen, not based upon what they assumed they would see. So that was a great evolution to watch.
It was such a flashpoint, obviously, and still reverberating years later when people came to see the play. How about now? What are you thinking might happen given the much broader reach of radio and podcast?
Well, I'm interested to see what a radio audience thinks about this, because radio audiences, particularly GPB audiences, are really smart and really on point, and they think about things and they chew on things and they discern things and they try and figure them out. So I'm just interested to see what GPB's audience's reaction is to this piece and to what it engenders in their minds.
Had you ever worked on a radio drama before?
No, I haven't. It was so fun to work on. I loved it.
How does that new medium, how does that expand on this story?
Well, I don't know. I'm really interested to see how it expands. Well, I guess we'll find out.
Atlanta playwright Lee Noel, her radio adaptation, or rather a radio adaptation of her play, Beyond Reasonable Doubt, The Troy Davis Project, airs this Sunday at 10 a.m. on GPB. Lee, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now stay with us. We're going to pick up the theme to a degree. We're going to speak to some reporters who cover the death penalty about how they've seen public opinion shift over the years and some of the factors and processes of the death penalty here in Georgia. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked to playwright Lee Noel about a radio drama premiering on GPB Radio and podcast this weekend. Reasonable Doubt, The Troy Davis Project, reflects multiple opinions on the case of Troy Davis, who was convicted of murder and executed in Georgia.
I think it'd be best if you chose something else to focus on. Take a yoga class.
A man's life is at stake and you want me to take a yoga class?
Allison, the man is guilty.
What if he's not?
And we're going to expand upon that conversation beyond the case to learn more about the death penalty and executions process here in Georgia and nationally. Rhonda Cook covered the criminal justice system and executions in Georgia since the 1990s for the AJC, and she joins us in the studio. Hello, Rhonda.
Hello there.
Welcome. Also with us is Maurice Shama. He's a staff writer for the Marshall Project. That's a nonprofit news organization covering criminal justice in the U.S. And Maurice, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Rhonda, just curious how you got onto this beat in the first place.
Well, it like a lot of things in my career, it was all an accident. I started covering prisons right out of the box when I became a reporter in 1977. And it just sort of evolved into this. And because I covered prisons, that led to the death penalty and execution, since they're the ones that carry out the punishment.
And the Department of Corrections selects 5 media witnesses for each execution. That's a role that you filled for dozens over the span of 2 decades or about there. The first execution you witnessed, that was in 1996. What do you remember about that day?
Well, I don't remember much about the executions I've covered. Some might argue it's a defensive thing, but
I mean, you sort of blocked them out?
Yes, but I do remember, that's one of the two that I do remember, and it was Larry Longshar. And he was convicted of a triple murder. And Larry Longshar did not appeal his conviction. He sort of did right at the last minute, but then changed his mind the next day. And I do remember that one. That one was an electrocution. It's the only electrocution that I witnessed. But I do remember that one because it was my first, because I knew Longshar well. Because it was an electrocution, there are lots of reasons why I remember that one.
And you said there was another.
The other one that I do remember was Kelly Gissendaner a couple of years ago. She was convicted of having her lover kill her husband. And that one stands out not because Kelly Gissendaner is the only woman I've seen executed, but because she sang Amazing Grace right up until she could no longer sing. And that stands out.
That's pretty chilling. For you, as a reporter, governed by the principles of objectivity, did witnessing all those executions leave you with any thoughts about capital punishment in Georgia or otherwise?
No, because I wasn't allowed to have those thoughts. Georgia is very efficient. The closest they've ever come to having a problem was with one of Kelly Gissendaner's, not the time she was executed, but the time before that. And they stepped in and stopped it because there was a problem with the drugs. It was cold. It had been stored at temperatures that were too cold. And the solids in the drug had begun to separate from the liquids. And so in an abundance of caution, they stopped that execution. And it was carried out about 6 months later. But Georgia has been drama free. They've got it pretty much down to it. There's a rhythm to it.
Maurice, this is something you've covered, death penalty stories all over the country. Georgia has had about 491 executions. This is since 1924. Rhonda mentioned the state's efficiency. How does Georgia compare to other states in terms of just the numbers?
It's kind of right in the middle. You know, you have states like Texas that carry out many, many executions and are almost kind of famous culturally for it. And then you have states that have abolished the death penalty totally. You have states that have the death penalty on the books and they sentence people to death, but then they sort of get squeamish about actually carrying out an execution. Georgia's right in the middle on that. You know, it carries out maybe 10 executions some years, a few less, a few more, but it's a state that kind of wants to kind of keep this system running in a kind of efficient way, like Rhonda said, but it also doesn't, you know, appear to want to kind of get the reputation of a place like Texas of being, you know, bloodthirsty or carrying these out over and over and over again. There were times, you know, in other states where there were 2 a week, and I don't know of examples like that in Georgia, though, you know, Rhonda, correct me if I'm wrong.
There's only one that there were a couple that I do recall, and one was the Larry Longshar. There was one that came the very next day. Mm-hmm. And then my memory tells me there was another one more recent, but those things tend to leave my mind after they're over.
Of course.
How many on death row now in Georgia?
I think there's around 55 or 6. I'm not really sure of the number, but it's somewhere between 50 and 60.
Go ahead, Maurice.
Oh, I was going to say that what happens is, you know, every state that carries out executions, no matter how many or how few, every once in a while, a case kind of pops up in the media and becomes a big deal. Sometimes it's because of issues with the lethal injection drugs, like the Kelly Kissendaner execution where those, you know, the pentobarbital separated. Other cases, it's like Troy Davis, where there's a really clear concern about someone being innocent, or in the case of Kelly Kissendaner, a woman, a kind of very sympathetic figure, and you find that these cases really kind of travel in the public mind because they kind of bring up a lot of ambivalence that people might have about the punishment.
And in her case, she was the person who was put to death while it was, I believe, her lover who actually committed the murder or was convicted of
the
murder?
That's correct. He agreed to a plea deal, and she declined to take the same. She had the same offer, and she did not take it. Mm-hmm. And so she went to trial, and then the jury chose the death sentence for her punishment.
And Maurice, this is Rhonda mentioned the first execution she saw was an electrocution. Later, lethal injection was adopted by the state of Georgia, something the Marshall Project has done a lot of reporting on. Tell us a little bit about some of the complications that states have had in obtaining lethal injection drugs for executions.
Sure. So lethal injections became the form of execution for a lot of states beginning in the 1980s and continuing up through the 90s. And the whole idea was that they would be a sort of more humane way of executing people, that it would kind of look more like a clinical sort of hospital setting. But in the late 2000s, around 2010-11, there was a problem with the production of one specific drug that was used in lethal injection. As a result, states had to kind of look to new sources, and defense lawyers kind of got wise to this, activists got wise to it, and they started putting pressure on pharmaceutical companies. And the result of all of this was that it became harder and harder for states to get the drugs, and that's where you started to see that the states that could get drugs, including Georgia, started to have problems with those drugs. They were getting them from less reputable or less regulated suppliers. There was a whole pretty zany story, frankly, involving states getting drugs from a sort of storefront in London that was the back of a driving school and like a strip mall. And this was the supplier that was getting drugs and shipping them over to the U.S. To departments of correction. A lot of bad press came with that. And then you started to see a few executions, not in Georgia, but in Oklahoma and Arizona and Ohio, in which there was what we would maybe call a botched execution, in which the person very visibly was in pain, gasping, failed to, prison officials failed to get a needle in, and just all kinds of gruesome stuff happened, and it suddenly kind of ruined in the public eye the idea that lethal injection was a kind of safe, humane, safe is a weird word because you are killing someone, but you know, sort of a humane way of doing it. And that is where we are now, where every once in a while you still hear about these kinds of problems accompanying lethal injection.
There is, incidentally, a terrific episode of More Perfect. That's from the people at Radiolab about halting lethal injections. I am speaking with the former AJC reporter Rhonda Cook and staff writer for the Marshall Project. His name is Maurice Shama, about the death penalty and execution process here in Georgia. And Rhonda, I want to go back to the Troy Davis case for a moment and play a clip from Annalise McPhail. She's the mother of Mark McPhail, the police officer that Troy Davis was accused of murdering. Here she is speaking to CNN in the lead up to Davis's execution.
I never get closure. I may get some peace because Mark will always be in my heart and in my life.
Now, Rhonda, you covered this case for the AJC there for his execution in 2011. Did you have any sense that it would be such a pivotal case, not just in Georgia, but nationally, even internationally?
Well, yeah, we saw the lead up to it. There were people weighing in like President Carter, the Pope. It was getting attention from all over the world, and it just intensified the closer we got to the date of execution. And he had four dates. He had three stays at the last minute. So it was a crescendo, and you could see it coming.
Well, why do you think the case got so much attention? Was it about the dynamics or the specifics of the case?
A little of both. You had his family, Troy Davis's family, was very good with the media and very good at getting folks behind them. And it went from there. His sister, who passed away not long after he was executed, she had cancer. She was the force behind all of this. And it was like a storm. And they had folks coming up behind them and supporting their position. And then you had seven of the nine witnesses who testified against him sort of back off their testimony. That has happened in other cases that I've covered. And consequently, then you'd have jurors saying, well, we've had second thoughts. And that's happened in other cases I've covered as well. But it just took on a life that it was a force. It was very strong. So that's, I think, what brought it so much attention.
Well, Troy Davis was not the first person in Georgia whose execution stirred up protests or across the country. And Maurice, this is something that you have covered. The death penalty in Georgia and other places, undeniably more African Americans are put to death and more people raised in poverty get the death sentence. So how do race and class play into who is on death row?
In sort of surprising and complex ways, Georgia was actually the site of a major study of who was sentenced to death and their race that became pivotal in a 1980s Supreme Court case called McCleskey versus Kemp. That was a really big deal because it was one of the first times since the 70s that the death penalty kind of as a whole was being attacked in a really big way and at a national level. And it came out of Georgia. And what that study at the time found was that if you were black, you were slightly more likely to be sentenced to death, but you were overwhelmingly more likely to be sentenced to death if the victim was white. That seemed to be the kind of main lesson from this research. Since then, there's been studies around the country. They tend to all show a version of that, maybe a stronger correlation with being black. This actually drove last week the Supreme Court in Washington State to strike down the death penalty there, saying, you know, the evidence basically shows that this is arbitrary, but also, you know, filled with racial disparities in a way that we're not comfortable with and that violates the Constitution. So, you see that kind of coming up more and more in the arguments that people make. You also see occasional cases where racism is so explicit that it's just kind of undeniable, like a juror who uses the N-word, a prosecutor who goes out of their way to make sure there are no black members of the jury, that sort of thing. And then on the class side of it, you tend to see, I mean, there's in defense lawyer circles, it's sort of well known that there's no one wealthy, independently wealthy on death row because, you know, most of these people are represented by court-appointed lawyers, and often those lawyers don't really have the resources to do a very good job, or they do their best, but they are sort of way overmatched by the state. And so, you know, one quip I've heard a defense lawyer say to me very skeptically is that, you know, those on death row didn't commit the worst crimes, they just had the worst lawyers. Mm. And I think that that's often borne out. I mean, there are also a lot of people on death row who committed very, very sort of atrocious, scary crimes. But there are also people who are not on death row who committed very scary and atrocious crimes as well. So sometimes, you know, you're always making these decisions. It's necessarily a kind of subjective thing. But every scholar who has looked at this really closely tends to see at least some effect of race and class.
You said that Washington State Supreme Court struck down the death penalty. What is happening nationally in public opinion and the actual political or policy decisions about the death penalty?
I think it's really in flux. You have a lot of states that are having these kind of big public debates about whether they want to have the death penalty. So in addition to Washington, Nebraska, the legislature voted down the death penalty there, but then the public through a referendum basically overruled the legislature and brought it back, and they carried out an execution last year. I've spent a lot of time covering a case in Nevada where a man is kind of like the case Rhonda mentioned earlier. He's given up his appeals and is asking to be executed, and the state can't seem to get it together to make it happen. So you see just a lot of kind of these chaotic, you know, turmoil-filled moments around individual executions. But overall, what we've seen is that the public, in most of the polls that get done on this, still support the death penalty, but not nearly by the margin that they used to. You know, it hovers around 50%, maybe a little more, but there were times in the 90s where it was, 60, 70, 80%, especially in states like Georgia and Texas. So we've seen definitely an ebb in terms of public support for this. And it kind of suggests that, maybe public support is a little bit tied to how much we're doing it. There's also just been such a decline in the use of the death penalty that maybe it's less that people are against it than they are just sort of apathetic, and you don't necessarily see that in the polls. But I think that individual opinions can be pretty complicated.
And Rhonda, just I want to close with you and ask, have you seen that change here in the state of Georgia, fewer people supporting the death penalty?
Well, yes, I've seen it in terms of media coverage and the number of people who come out and protest the executions. The last few that I covered, that I witnessed, there would be no one out there from the media for us to report to. There would be a few of the usual protesters, and they would sort of pack up and leave as soon as it was over.
Rhonda Cook, she's former reporter for the AJC. She covered the criminal justice system. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Happy to be here.
Also, Maurice Shama, he's staff writer for the Marshall Project. Thank you so much, Maurice.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Now, the music we're hearing is from the Troy Davis radio drama. It's called Strange Dog Walk by Blue Dot Sessions. And stay with us. We're going to take a turn here and speak with cybersecurity experts gathering in Atlanta this week on how to keep our personal data and national elections safe. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. New sculptures will soon take center stage at the University of Georgia's Georgia Museum of Art. And tomorrow we meet Richard Hunt. He's the legendary artist behind the work. We're going to be talking with him about his life and his work in and outside of the studio. Election manipulation, the cybersecurity breach that held the city of Atlanta for ransom, hacks of Facebook, Equifax, Target, and millions of people's data. Clearly, our computers are vulnerable. Atlanta is one of the fastest-growing high-tech metro areas in the U.S. and now ranks third in cities with the most Fortune 500 headquarters. And this week, thousands of cybersecurity experts are going to be gathering at Cybersecurity Atlanta to discuss their concerns about the industry's security and lack of it. And joining me this morning are two cybersecurity experts. The event's director, David Juniper, is with us, and chief hacker, Joshua Crumbaugh. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. So, David, you're the one with the English accent for the help of our listeners. Start with you. What are the payoffs that hackers are looking for when they go into a computer or a network?
Well, I mean, what they're trying to do is get what's valuable to an organization or an individual. So that might be someone's credit card information, or it might be a company's data, which they can either hold at ransom for a fee, or to be selling that information on the dark web, like credit card information, etc.
So, Joshua, we have this idea that hackers are quite notorious, secretly breaking into systems to steal information or credit card numbers, as David mentioned. You are the white hat variety of hacker, finding weaknesses in systems. So what are the chief reasons computers or systems are left vulnerable?
You know, it might be slightly controversial, but it's my belief that it is completely people that are the reasons that we have so many issues. Take the Georgia malware attack or ransomware incident that recently happened. There were vulnerabilities that were unpatched and were well-known vulnerabilities on their perimeter that allowed this to happen. And if you take it back even further, it's the bad code, the insecure coding practices of the developers that caused that to happen as well. And so it's my belief that cybersecurity is really more of a human issue than it is a technical or computer issue, and it's more about changing our society from the ground up to make sure that when we write code, we're writing it more secure, and when we find out about vulnerabilities that exist within our networks or on our perimeter that are public or internet facing, that we get them properly patched in a timely manner, so that the bad guys, the hackers out there, they can't exploit those, and they can't exploit our people because our people are being more security aware and are paying attention before they just start clicking on things.
Here is the mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, talking about that attack specifically.
This is much bigger than a ransomware attack. This really is an attack on our government, which means it's an attack on all of us.
So what do we know about the people who ended up holding the city for ransom? The city, by the way, declined to pay.
There's a lot of suspicions about who actually was involved in that. I'm going to decline to comment because it's a lot of people assuming that they know. But what we do know is that they were exploiting known vulnerabilities within systems that really should never have been exposed to the internet in the first place, such as remote desktop, which is just a way to remotely access any computer. But if you ask any cybersecurity professional or ethical hacker, they'll tell you that that should be behind a secure system. And so it's a hygiene thing that that needs to be fixed.
Which other public organizations besides cities are most vulnerable to these kind of ransomware attacks?
That's a loaded question. Honestly, everybody is highly vulnerable to these types of attacks. In my career as an ethical hacker, I've yet to find a single network or system that I couldn't gain access to and take full, complete control over. And we're talking anything from pipelines to taking remote control of oil rigs to some of the largest financial institutions and even markets in the world. And so the reality is where we sit right now, any hacker, if it were targeted enough, could easily breach systems. And we're always talking in terms of data breaches, and fortunately, most cybercrime is financially motivated. But if somebody had more nefarious, purposes or goals, we could be talking loss of life instead of just loss of data or loss of income or loss of reputation. And so I think it's something that we really need to take seriously as a society and understand that with all this new technology that we love, it brings new threats and it brings essentially a war front right to our front door. And it's cyber, but it can affect us in our everyday life. And that means we need to be more security aware.
Well, David, as Joshua was saying, our lives are increasingly integrated with computers, you know, thinking of the Internet of Everything, your smart home devices, your car, your pacemaker, things that if you watch enough television or movies could have us living in perpetual fear. Do you live in fear?
Well, I don't think you can live like that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to move on with our lives. But I think doing things or having events like Cybersecurity Atlanta, bringing awareness to cybersecurity, not just to not enterprise or big companies that we hear within the news, but making people aware, you know, on an individual basis, making sure, as Joshua said, you know, making sure you patch your home computers, making sure that your passwords are up to date, doing everything you can. And as also, you know, people are the biggest weakness within cybersecurity. And so it's about whatever organization or size you are, understanding where those potential weaknesses are and educating your staff, even if you're a company of, you know, 5 to 10 people up to, you know, multinationals, you need to understand where the risks are. And by coming to an event like Cybersecurity Atlanta, you can learn what the latest threats are, you can hear from the experts, you can see what's coming up, and you can talk to the vendors that are the experts in this field to understand what you need to do to protect yourself personally, but also as an organization.
So when we hear about attacks on the city of Atlanta, for example, and I understand that hospitals are also often targeted, universities often targeted, we have a sense, I think, that, well, I don't know if my data was affected, so do people really pay enough attention? You know what? How attacks like this might affect you personally?
Well, yeah, I think that people do have to take notice. The latest, you know, breach with Facebook, which is obviously a lot of people use that. You need to make sure that you've gone back onto Facebook to see if you were one of the accounts affected and make sure that you've updated or go through their protocol and what they recommend that you should do. So I think the more that it is in the media, I think more people will be aware of it. And the more that we push to make sure that companies are making sure they tell people if there has been a breach, so that they can do whatever they can to protect their own data. You know, it's not going away. You know, we're constantly trying. It's an arms race in terms of keeping ahead of the hackers or the bad guys. And so, personally or as an organization, you need to do whatever you can to make sure that your information that you don't want to get out is protected as much as you can.
That's David Juniper. He's Event Director for Cybersecurity Atlanta. Also with us is Chief Hacker Joshua Crumbaugh. Josh, we hear terms like malware, ransomware, spyware when these kind of breaches are reported. What are the differences that we should know about?
You know, the reality is it doesn't matter what type of attack they're coming after you with. The attacks are prevalent, whether you're on social media such as Facebook or you're in your email. You just need to be careful with what you're clicking on. And echoing what David said, you need to keep your stuff patched. You need to have strong passwords. As far as the different types of malware, ransomware, it's a type where it will lock up your files or encrypt your files, and it will make it to where you can't access them without paying somebody money. Now, if you had those same files backed up, then you could just restore it and gain access. There's a million different types of malware, though, at the end of the day. And the reality is we just need to be more aware and watch what we're doing and be very careful about all of our actions when we're online, because the bad guys are in our social media feeds the exact same way that our friends are there and our colleagues are there.
Do you think people are that proactive? I mean, I know many people after the hacks on Facebook asked them if they went and changed their privacy settings. A lot of people don't. We become a little complacent about this kind of stuff, or maybe even don't report that we've been hacked. Is that part of the problem?
It absolutely is. In fact, if you're working at an organization and you get malware on your computer, the organization should know, but too often they don't. And one of the worst things that you can do, if you were to, let's say, click on an email, and after you click on it, you realize it didn't go to the right site, is not report that immediately. Because the sooner the defenders and the incident responders know about it, the less damage it may cause, and the quicker that they can remediate it. So, yes, we need to tell people when something happens and bring in the experts. But on top of that, we absolutely need to be more aware. And you're right, too many people, they have become complacent. And so they get this notice, hey, your email and your password were compromised in this data breach, and they don't change their password. And so as an ethical hacker, one of the ways that it's easy to get into companies is you go to the latest breach, you see if any of their employees were involved in the breach, which they shouldn't be using their work emails, but they too often do, and then you grab their password and you go try it against the VPN, and you'd be amazed at how often they don't even change their password between systems or within the same system that was breached.
Well, we know this kind of phishing expedition led to the hack at the DNC. And we know also Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian meddling during the 2016 campaign has issued indictments now for dozens of Russian intelligence officials, most of them now in Russia. So any conclusions yet on how they interfered?
Well, there's a number of ways that they interfered. Everything from, yes, phishing, like we saw with the Podesta emails, over to fake news, which we hear about all the time, but fake news in order to polarize our people even more and make them believe that there were things against the opposite party that maybe weren't true. But beyond that, it's also in places like hotels, like I'm at right now, or airports especially, where espionage agents will sit there and they will put up fake networks and intercept traffic from political leaders or even just people's computers. And in doing so, they may infect your computer, they may just steal data, but when we're out using public Wi-Fi, that's something we need to be aware of, and they have tools to help secure all of your traffic. It's called a VPN or a virtual private network. They're easy to use, they're very affordable, and most of them come with a little app you download and you just click connect, and what it does is it secures your traffic. And so when you're using public Wi-Fi, especially especially when you're using public Wi-Fi. It's so important to use a VPN. And unfortunately, it gets back to that the human side of it, too many of our even political leaders are unaware of the security ramifications of how they may use their computers.
Well, besides profiles, fake news, propaganda, there's vulnerability in the election rolls. We recently spoke with Georgia Tech's computer science professor, Richard DeMillo, about potential for voting machine hacking.
Those of us who spend our time trying to figure out what's going on in cyberspace know that every time you introduce a computer into a process, you increase the risk. And we just walked through the number of different computers that are involved in administering Georgia's election system. Every single one of those introduces vulnerabilities and risks.
So we've been talking about the multiple risks, the human side, what we can do. But these are things that actually really erode public trust and faith in our system of government and how elections are conducted. So this is such a big thing. You know, the business you all are in, the industry is about protecting people. But how do you change attitudes when something is, you know, so easy to use or appears to be so easy to use?
Well, that's a difficult question. That's actually one of my goals is to help to better educate the world and to change some of these views. But you're absolutely correct. I was at a conference recently that I spoke at where there was a 13-year-old that was, you know, very easily able to hack a voting machine. And it's actually common at some of these cybersecurity conferences where they'll bring them in. And the whole idea is to bring more awareness to it and hopefully find more vulnerabilities and secure them. But at the same time, we as a people need to have faith in our governments and our election systems that they're not going to roll out vulnerable technology. And so I do think it is a flaw from our leaders that they're not properly vetting these systems and hiring people like myself and the many others that will be at this event to go in and check these systems for vulnerabilities and ensure that they are secure long before we ever put them into production.
Well, you mentioned the 13-year-old in one of the most notable hacks in recent history in 2016, almost like a Hollywood movie. Three guys, not even old enough to drink legally, working out of a college dorm, basically shut down a huge chunk of the internet. But of course, there is a perfectly legal market for personal data. There's a business infrastructure of brokers selling to advertisers, marketers that help you, you know, narrow your choices on Netflix, and our own government. So how many steps should people be taking to protect their data? Should they be letting it out anywhere? I'll put that to either of you, David or Josh.
Probably Josh is probably in the better place to answer that one.
I think that we need to be accepting that certain forms of data that we used to rely on as a form of authentication and to verify us, that they are just no longer able to be used. We need to come up with new and better ways. So a social security number, for example, if you're an American, you probably have had your social security number breached thanks to the Equifax breach in particular. And if you look at that, that was very similar. It was a known vulnerability, or very similar to the Georgia ransomware attack, but it was a known vulnerability that they had. DHS even alerted to them about it, but it never got patched, and it led to the release of nearly every single American's social security number. And honestly, if you didn't get an alert in the mail, I'm guessing it got lost in the mail. And so, yes, we need to be very careful about what data is out there about ourselves, but I think it's different data because there's certain amounts of data that we just can't control. But what we can control is getting on Facebook and giving out basically our password. So if you're using a password, let's say it's your pet's name, and then you go on to Facebook, and you post all these pictures of your pet or your cat, your dog, whatever it happens to be.
Josh, I'm going to have to stop you there because we're running up against a break. Useful information, Josh Crumbaugh and David Juniper. Have a great conference this week.
Thanks very much.
Cheers. Bye.
That's it for our show today. This is On Second Thought from Georgia Public Broadcasting.